You're listening to the Rogues Radio Podcast, your home for creator interviews, comic book reviews, industry news and commentary, and the Retro Retrospective Movie Review Show. Welcome you to this episode of the Rogues Radio Podcast. My name is Dave Beatty, and I am one of your hosts for, it seems like, a very, very long time. Maybe not long enough for some people. But anyhow, for a long time, I've been a professional illustrator, graphic designer, comic book artist. I've done sketch cards, all kinds of fun, crazy stuff with things that people have heard of, like X-Men and Batman and Guardians of the Galaxy and all that fun stuff. But enough about that. I want to welcome back my co-host. This is Mr. Eric Alexander. Eric, please tell the folks listening at home a little bit about what you've done as a creative professional.
Well, I am the associate producer of the feature film Occupants, which features Star Trek Voyager actor Robert Picardo. I was also the publisher and editor for the official comic book tie-in of that film, and I am also the chief financial officer of Bad Bob Productions.
It is now time to start the show the way we always do, with the movie and news roundup segment. So tell me, Eric, what's happening in the world of movie and TV news?
Well, almost immediately after we recorded our last episode, there was a pretty interesting news story regarding Kevin Feige and Lucasfilm. Apparently, it looks like Kevin Feige is going to be producing at least one Star Wars film, which I found really surprising. Especially considering where we're at with Star Wars right now. I would think it would be all about promoting the latest film. And I was a little shocked that they all of a sudden came out with this Kevin Feige news that he's going to be producing a film. Now, if people don't know who Kevin Feige is, which I would imagine most of our listeners do, Kevin Feige is the person that's probably most responsible for the MCU. He is the producer that's pretty much been involved with everything, including Marvel films that aren't even considered part of the MCU. So it's an interesting situation, because on the one side, there's been all this talk that Bob Iger is fine with Kathleen Kennedy, and there's supposedly no problems there. Of course, that's depending who you listen to. And then all of a sudden, we get this news that Kevin Feige is indeed going to be producing a film with Lucasfilm, apparently with Kathleen Kennedy, which can present problems because you're talking about two very big names there in terms of film production. I mean, Kathleen Kennedy essentially runs the Lucasfilm studio, and Kevin Feige essentially runs Marvel Studios. So it's a very interesting pairing. I'm curious what your reaction was when you heard about this, Dave.
Well, when I heard about it, my initial thought was I thought it sounded like a good idea, just because I've been a fan of pretty much all of the MCU films that Kevin Feige's been involved with. And I know that he is, and with the MCU stuff for sure, I'm not so sure about the Marvel stuff, but I know he's a fan, you know, of a lot of these characters as far as the MCU stuff goes. And he comes to it with a different love and appreciation that, you know, someone else may not have. So that made me feel good. You know, as far as him working with, you know, Kathleen Kennedy, I really don't think it'd be that big a deal, just because he's already been working with, was it Amy Pascal, doing the Spider-Man stuff, you know, with courting Spider-Man into the MCU. So as far as I can tell, it all sounds good to me. I don't have anything other than high hopes that, you know, whatever film it is that Kevin Feige is involved with will hopefully be, you know, good. So as they say, time will tell.
You don't think it's odd in terms of the timing of the announcement? Because really, in my mind, we should be focusing on the latest Star Wars film that's coming out in December.
The timing's a little weird, but I also think, too, they're just, in my mind anyway, I think they're trying to keep Star Wars in the public consciousness in a positive way, in my mind. And I think they're hoping that this news that Kevin Feige is going to be involved with some of the films or one of the films or whatever going forward, I think they're just trying to put a positive spin on things because some people are not looking forward to, you know, Rise of Skywalker. So that's my only thought. I think they're, in a weird way, they're kind of going, you know, say, stick with us because all these good things are right down the road, you know, in the hopes that people will continue to support Star Wars. Because I know that, what is it, Galaxy's Edge, according to a lot of reports I've heard, the attendance at Galaxy's Edge is not what they were expecting. It's, you know, it's not bad, but it's just, it's not the huge, you know, hit that I think they were planning on or expecting. But I think a lot of that, too, can be couched with the fact that when you look at Galaxy's Edge, it's not really all the Star Wars characters that everyone really grew up with. You know, it's all new things. The Millennium Falcon, you know, we all know. You know, Chewbacca, we know. But it's not like you have the classic characters. The cantina isn't a version of the cantina from the original Star Wars. You know what I mean? That's not bad, but it's just, I think it's slightly unfamiliar, you know, and it, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into that, but I really have a feeling that they were just putting out some positive, hopefully, Star Wars news to keep people on board. That's my thought, as far as the timing goes, anyway.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Galaxy's Edge, because one of the things we didn't talk about in our last report when we were talking about Bob Iger and some of the excerpts from his book regarding George Lucas that came out. One of the stories that was kind of buried in that was that actually the head of the amusement park division of Disney, the person most responsible for Galaxy's Edge, had been let go, depending on who you ask or depending on who's telling the story. But it sounds like she was pushed out. And a big part of that was the apparent... I'll go a little farther than you. The apparent failure of Galaxy's Edge in terms of actually bringing new attendees to Disneyland and being sort of an attraction in and of itself, which was what the big hope was. I don't think they've reached the goals that they were hoping for at all regarding Galaxy's Edge. And I do think in large part that is because they are not putting anything in there that is faithful to the original trilogy. They're just kind of doing their own thing. Even... what's bizarre to me is a lot of the stuff in Galaxy's Edge isn't even based on the new trilogy. It's like its own thing. So I don't really understand where they're going with that. I know in the past I did report about the rumor that possibly George Lucas gets some sort of residuals from the original characters. And that might be something that went into this decision. But I can tell you everything that I've heard is said that Galaxy's Edge is a pretty big failure. And as I mentioned, the head of the amusement park division of Disney had left the company right when Bob Iger's excerpts came out from his book. So that kind of overshadowed it. And then almost immediately after that, we get the news with Kevin Feige. So I question the timing. I think the timing is suspect.
Well, and like I said, I really have the feeling that the timing, again, is to put something positive out while there's these negative things too. You know what I mean? Either, like, in my mind, I'm really thinking they're trying to just say, stay with us, there's good things coming up, you know, or you could look at it as trying to have a big, huge announcement basically run cover for this other kind of negative thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? To hopefully the one that's louder, the one that people are going to be more excited about, will gloss over the other not so great thing that no one, they want you, you know, they don't want you talking about. So.
Yeah, I can see that.
know there's always fun things going on in the more, I guess, the superhero genre of movies and TV shows and all that kind of stuff. Is there anything interesting going on, like in the superhero world that you might be interested in talking about?
Well, I think a big news and also a good segue from our last segment. Kevin Feige once again is in the news because apparently he has negotiated a deal with Sony that brings Spider-Man back into the MCU. So I know a lot of people were really happy about that. A lot of people were really happy to hear that, including my daughters. They were a little bit bummed when they heard that Spider-Man was not going to be in the MCU anymore. So I think they're pretty excited. I think it's a good thing overall for the character and the franchise. I don't know how good it is for either company. It's kind of interesting getting into the details of that negotiation. As I understand it, Disney wanted a straight 50-50 split, which was very different than the deal they had before. I guess the deal they had before was some kind of a royalty. So they decided they want to get more into an actual percentage split of the gross. And my understanding is they eventually settled on 25%. So I guess they did give a little bit in terms of what Disney wanted to Sony, since Sony is the one who holds the rights. So I thought that was pretty interesting, especially with all the drama before going back and forth about them splitting. But apparently they're back together and they made nice. Did you have any reaction to that, Dave?
Well, I'm excited to know that Spider-Man will continue to be a part of the MCU. I mean, I think that's a good thing. Now I do know too that it's not a very, you know, far reaching deal. I think it's like one more Spider-Man movie kind of with them working together, and then I think it's one more MCU movie. So basically they can kind of see Spider-Man's way out.
Yeah, my understanding was the deal was it's one Spider-Man movie and then one essentially Avengers movie would be my guess. So that's all the deal covers. So yes, you're right. My understanding is that the scope of the deal is very limited. Obviously, Sony is trying to do something with their Spider-Verse ideas. You know, they started that with the animated film. I do see that bleeding into the films. That kind of was like a false start that they had with the last Spider-Man film, because they were kind of introducing the idea of the multiverse, but then it turned out it was a spoiler alert. It was a scam. So it wasn't really the multiverse, right? But the multiverse was also kind of hinted at already with Endgame. So that's already part of the MCU as well. I just kind of want to point that out, that as far as the multiverse concept goes, that's already solidly introduced in Endgame as well.
Right. And then I know that the other thing too, that had people, you know, curious to see how they're going to do the whole Spider-Verse thing, is one of the projects that was announced that was in development was a movie for Madame Web. And Madame Web is one of those really unusual kind of Spider-Man, Spider-Universe type of characters that I think most people are not too terribly familiar with. I mean, I think people might be more familiar with Madame Web if they watched the 90s Spider-Man cartoon and they happened to catch like the kind of fun two-parter where you had all the different Spider-Man from all the different universes, you know, having to work together. But that's a very unusual property to try and develop. But I think with that, I think definitely on Sony's side anyway, in my mind, I think they are definitely wanting to try to do something more with the multiverse beyond just what they did with obviously the animated Spider-Man movie that came out that I thought was pretty good.
Yeah, I actually loved it. I thought it was awesome. I love Spider-Ham. He's one of my favorites. So, but another interesting thing with that is I recently became more aware of the Japanese version of Spider-Man, the Japanese live-action Spider-Man. Are you familiar with that?
I am. I've seen a little bit of it here and there. You know, he's got the vehicle and the robot and the whole thing. So it's a very different version of Spider-Man.
Well, apparently there was a rumor from the I believe the director of the Spider-Verse animated film. There was a rumor that he said that if the film made a certain amount of money, he would consider bringing that character into the Spider-Verse, which would be really interesting because that character is really hard to get your hands on because of all the rights issues. Because obviously what had happened was a Japanese company had essentially made a kind of a trade-off with Marvel, where Marvel had access to their IP, and they had access to Marvel's IP and can kind of do whatever they wanted to do with it. And it doesn't seem like either company really exploited it that much. I think the Shogun Robot series in the Marvel comics was the biggest thing that Marvel did on their end.
Right. The Shogun Warriors.
Right. That was part of that same company. And of course, on the Japanese end, they had what I understood was a very successful live action show in Japan. And it's almost impossible to see that now because of the rights issue.
Yeah, I can see where that's definitely, you know, complicates. Yeah. I think it'd be really cool, though. I would love to see them introduce that character into the animated or even the live action, for that matter. You know what I mean? It's a very different portrayal, but it's also a lot of fun. Because that's the main thing I enjoy with the superhero movies. I want escapism, and I want to enjoy myself, and I want to have fun with it. You know, you can hit me with that outlandish concept. You still got to make it work, you know, within the context of the story. But no, I think that sounds like a lot of fun. So,
I agree.
And along the same lines, talking about introducing various versions of characters into things and fun, have you seen any of the photos that have been coming out lately for the Crisis event they're doing on the CW?
I haven't. I have not, actually.
There have been some amazing shots of Brandon Routh as the Kingdom Come version of Superman. And it's kind of neat because you can definitely tell. Because the Kingdom Come version of Superman is... In the original story, and I think also in the Crisis event, I could be wrong, but I don't think I am. It very much represents the classic version of Superman, the version that we grew up with. And it very much will, I think, recast and kind of show everyone that the version of Superman that's in Supergirl is very much the new 52 version of Superman. And I think it'll be easier for people to kind of understand why that Supergirl version of Superman is kind of different. You know what I mean? Because he's kind of a more updated interpretation of it. But the photos they've been releasing, I mean, Brandon Routh looks great in the Kingdom Come costume. But one of the coolest photos I've seen actually here recently was they had an amazing shot of him actually standing with the Supergirl version of Superman. I think his name's Tyler Hoechlin. I might be pronouncing that wrong. And that was amazing to see two Supermen standing next to each other. And know that they're going to be...
I am looking at that picture right now.
That is so friggin' cool. I just think that's really neat. And I think that's a lot of fun. I loved with the event they did last year with Elseworlds. I had enjoyed that, just seeing John Wesley Shipp, the little bit he was in it as the 90s Flash. And to think that in this event we might get a chance to see the 90s Flash with Brandon Routh's, you know, Kingdom Come Superman... Kevin Conroy in there as Bruce Wayne. You know what I mean? Like the old man Bruce Wayne. It's really a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's something I need to look into more because I did hear the rumblings about this, but I didn't actually get a chance to read an article, and I'm actually looking at some pictures, you know, as we're talking, and that is pretty cool.
It's really neat because they have a shot of Brandon Routh and he's doing the hands on the hips. But if you look at the way they've styled the costume, it's the Kingdom Come version of Superman. But because Alex Ross is such a classic Superman fan, it looks like just an older version of the classic Superman. And that's the thing I really like about it. This next segment is definitely going to be no joke, but obviously we couldn't talk about it in a superhero segment because we're going to be talking about villains, I guess, for a little bit, or anti-heroes, however you want to look at them. So tell me, Eric, what's going on in the world of the anti-heroes and the villains?
Well, it's the news about Joker's been out for a while. We didn't get into it very much. Actually, we didn't get into it at all in our previous shows. There's obviously a lot of controversy going on about Joker right now, in terms of, I guess, the level of violence and, I guess, the overall feel of the film. I haven't had a chance to really read any reviews yet myself, But I know that things seem to be, things have taken a very weird, odd, and disturbing turn, I think, in terms of criticism of the Joker. Now, the funny thing for me is, when I first started hearing about this, I hadn't even seen the second trailer. I'd seen the first one, and I thought it was intriguing. And so then I watched the second one, and it kind of gave me a different interpretation of what's going on. And then I started to kind of delve into it a little bit more with the YouTube videos and theories about what's going on. But it's kind of interesting because at the same time, now we just had the Birds of Prey trailer just came out. And I watched that one, and I honestly hate it. I hated the trailer. So it's kind of interesting to me because it seems in a lot of ways, at least initially what I'm hearing is Birds of Prey is kind of being praised for the same reasons that the Joker is being dismissed. So I'm kind of interested on your take on it, just as a fan. What have you thought of the trailers? Let's start there. What have you thought of the two Joker trailers and the Bird of Prey trailer?
Well, here's kind of the thing with Joker and Birds of Prey. To make a long story short, both of them, in a lot of ways, are departures from the characters. And what I mean by that is, you know that Joaquin Phoenix is playing the Joker, and he looks kind of like the Joker, but it's not the Joker that we're really all very familiar with, one. Okay, it's set in the 80s. We're doing the whole thing where there's no Batman again. I'm going to talk about my impressions of the film in just a moment, but I'm just laying the groundwork here. You look at Birds of Prey, for example, and the emancipation of one Harley Quinn. I like Harley Quinn as a character. I've loved the character since Batman the Animated Series. But you also have the Birds of Prey in this movie. And to be honest, I know Black Canary is the one holding the microphone, and I know Huntress is the one holding the crossbow on the motorcycle. But other than that, and I know Montoya is going to be the officer leaving the Gotham City, you know, police department that we see in the trailer. And it may be a great movie, I don't know. But my initial impression with Birds of Prey is just, wow, in a weird way, it reminds me of those things about movies in the 90s that I always disliked. And it's where they change a bunch of stuff. You know, and it's not necessarily an improvement. If you change something and it's an improvement, great, you know. And I'm withholding my judgment until I see the film, you know. But at first blush, my impression is, wow, you threw all the things that we would know as iconic things for these characters. You threw a lot of it away, you know. So most of them are almost unrecognizable. And I think for casual fans who might be a little familiar with the characters from the anime cartoons and stuff, they probably don't even realize that is Huntress or that is Black Canary, you know? So that's my initial thing, is that they've changed so much stuff that it feels like it is something completely different. Now, that doesn't mean it's necessarily bad. I am a little bit more excited to see Joker than I am Birds of Prey, because I think that they're making some interesting and bold artistic choices. That being said, those bold artistic choices are a lot of the things that's inspiring the controversy and kind of bringing about some concern. And I can see all that. I liked the first trailer, and I actually kind of liked the second trailer. Now, I did, unfortunately, accidentally, I wasn't trying to do it, but after it screened at Cannes or whatever, somebody had a cell phone in the audience and filmed some footage. So I did see one of the big controversial scenes that happens in the movie. And it was a little shocking for me. I was a little shocked at what I was witnessing. This movie definitely has a Taxi Driver vibe, like big time. Like, I mean, even more so than I thought. I thought visually they were kind of cluing into it. But, I mean, it's very much that. So my initial reaction is I'm looking forward to Joker because of the artistic choices. I'm hoping the concern about what people think that the movie is going to inspire turns out to not be true because of what happened when Dark Knight came out. You know, that's understandable why people would be fearful, you know, but I'm hoping that that's not going to be the case. And then as far as Birds of Prey goes, I think the biggest barometer for that was that I showed it to my wife, and she pretty much just straight up just didn't like it. And my wife loves Harley Quinn. It's one of her favorite characters. And if Micah is turning a blind eye to it, going, yeah, I don't know, then I think they, at least as, if they're not, here's the thing. If they're trying not to court the long-term DC Comics fans and just grab new people and general audience, then, you know, maybe good job. Maybe you did that. If you're trying to court the long-term DC Comics fans, this is an example of like what they used to do back in the 90s. I think they've changed too much and they've gone too far. So that's my initial thought about Birds of Prey anyway.
Yeah, it is interesting because, you know, Birds of Prey obviously is a follow-up to Suicide Squad. And Suicide Squad is part of the DCEU. I guess that's the correct term. So it is considered part of that wider DC universe, although I don't really even understand what the state of the DCEU is at this point. But in theory, Birds of Prey would fall into that. I think it's interesting that you identified some of the characters in the trailer, because that actually helps me out a little bit, because I couldn't identify anybody in the trailer other than Harley Quinn. I am a huge, huge, huge Harley Quinn fan, to the point that one of my daughter's names is Harley. So I'm a huge Harley Quinn fan from the original 90s Batman animated series. I have the comic book adaptation of Mad Love. It's one of my prized possessions, and that's in the Bruce Timm style. And you know, I love that stuff. I love the origin story of her, and I didn't see really any of that in Suicide Squad, other than, you know, the these little flashback type things. And Suicide Squad disappointed me a lot as well. I don't like that film. I did think Harley Quinn was the breakout character of that ensemble, but I thought the ensemble was pretty weak, in my personal opinion. It wasn't the kind of it just didn't resonate with me. So my initial reaction with the trailer is I'm not impressed. I don't really like what they're doing with the characters. Like I said, as far as the other characters go, like Huntress or I think you said Detective Montoya, right? Some of those other characters I'm familiar with, I couldn't recognize them. I didn't know what was going on. It just, to me, wasn't a very well put together trailer. Now with Joker, the interesting thing is, I think anybody who's paying attention knows this is a one-off thing. This is an interpretation of the Joker. This is not "quote unquote" the Joker of the, you know, of the DCEU, of the comics, of anything. This is a specific interpretation of the Joker, and so.
But
yes,
let me chime in. But that being said, are you familiar with the concept of the three Jokers?
I think I've heard it before. Refresh me on that.
So in DC Comics lore, okay, there is this, I know at one time it was a series that Geoff Johns was developing, and I'm not sure if that's still going to be coming out or not, but in the DC Comics universe, there has been played up and then played down this concept that there wasn't really one quote-unquote Joker, that there's actually been different iterations of the Joker. And this comes back to this concept of what they call the three Jokers, that the reason Joker appears to die and come back is it's not always necessarily the same person. The Joker that we mostly know of that has always had conflict with Batman, quote unquote, could maybe be considered the third Joker. Okay. And that he's been an urban legend and an urban myth, and other people have assumed his identity, you know, over the years, kind of in the same way that Batman in the comics, sometimes they play up the idea that he'd been active for a long time and no one knew about it, but he was kind of an urban legend. It's a concept that they kind of play with from time to time. Approach it, you know, Joaquin Phoenix's Joker, depending on how they approach it, technically could be sort of in canon in the DCU. It just depends upon how they approach the subject matter. Now, obviously the film was produced and intended to be a one-off Elseworlds kind of thing, which I'm down with, but it's confusing I guess for me, it's just kind of confusing to the extent that we have this Birds of Prey movie coming out, and it's kind of in continuity or in canon or however you want to look at it. It's just kind of jarring, you know? I mean, I don't understand. Well, I understand, you know, Margot Robbie is a popular, you know, star, and it's just kind of weird. I guess that's my problem with the DC universe on movies, is it's a little bit too sporadic and hard to pin down. I mean, I guess we'll see what happens when Wonder Woman 84 comes out, you know, like, because I've heard rumblings that even Wonder Woman 84 may not be in canon anymore, or technically, quote unquote, in the DCU EU anymore. I don't know. It's just all kind of confusing.
It is confusing. I hadn't heard that about Wonder Woman. That's pretty nuts. Actually, that is kind of one of my big criticisms of Warner Brothers, because I consider myself a DC guy. I don't consider myself a Marvel guy. I consider myself a DC guy. And it kind of, I think it's weird the way that Time Warner does things, because, you know, we had this situation for a while where we had Gotham, which was completely its own universe. Then we had the CW shows, right, that are, some of them are in the same universe, some of them aren't, but they cross over into the multiverse, because we get that through Flash, the multiverse. And then you had the DCEU, I guess that's the correct term, the films. And they had their own continuity and their own versions. And while I understand, you know, as a DC fan, that there are these multiple versions, you know, that have developed of these different characters over time, basically to deal with all the continuity problems. But I liked the Marvel approach a lot better, where they were relating even the shows on Netflix, even though they didn't necessarily affect anything in the movies, they at least acknowledge the events of the movies. And the same thing with like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and things like that. It wasn't like they had a great continuity going on between the TV shows and the movies, but at least the TV shows acknowledged the movies, and you kind of figured it was all in the same universe. Warner Brothers' approach is completely different. And so that's just the way they are. I don't think they're going to change. So, you know, at least the thing with Joker is, at least from my perspective, you know, I know it's a one-off, it's a one-shot. I see what you're saying as far as the way it could fit into the bigger continuity, especially if it's successful. If it's successful, then, yeah, you don't know what they're going to do. You know, then there's always a possibility of a sequel. There's always a possibility of them bringing that into the mainstream. I do think of it more as a one-off, as opposed to Birds of Prey, which is supposed to be part of the bigger collection. And at least in my personal opinion, of the two films, I'm more interested in Joker than I am Birds of Prey. I do think a lot of the controversy, while it's somewhat understandable, it seems interesting to me that you're not hearing that with Birds of Prey. Now, granted, Birds of Prey, the trailer just barely came out, so maybe that'll come down the road. And I already saw an article that was making the argument that Joker is a right-wing film and Birds of Prey is a left-wing film. You know, that kind of stuff, you know, take it for what it is. You know, right now, I'm just going to say I think Joker looks more compelling than Birds of Prey.
Yeah, and I'd have to say I agree with that, because that's the thing for me, too, is that Joker just looks to be, in my mind anyway, because of how it's put together and how it's presented, it does appear to be more compelling and more interesting. And in some ways, I think more intellectually challenging, too, to be bluntly honest. And it's funny too, because we were talking in the previous segment how excited I am about the Crisis event. You know, I don't have to have everything make quote unquote just perfectly logical sense, but at the same time that they tried to do the interconnected DCEU with varying degrees of success, and then I feel like Birds of Prey is a leftover from that, you know, still trying to be in universe, kind of how, you know, Aquaman, you know, was definitely in universe, and then Shazam sort of was in universe too, I guess.
Shazam's got to be in universe, doesn't it?
Yeah, because I guess Superman showed up, so I guess it's got to be. But I mean, I guess we'll just see. I mean, I like the Elseworlds concept, because I would like to see them develop other things, like, you know, Red Son might be fun to see as a movie. I don't know how much marketability there is for that, but Superman Red Son, you know, Gotham by Gaslight would be amazing. So I would love to see some of these other things developed into films. We'll have to see. But when I look at what they're doing and I look at what the CW, you know, universe or whatever is being doing on television, you know, there's your interconnected DC universe.
Right.
You know what I mean? With all the characters coming and going, you know, and now we're going to see, you know, the other iterations that have been on television celebrated. I mean, there's your interconnected universe. You know what I mean? So I'm completely good with one-offs. But I guess that's the thing with Birds of Prey I find confusing is it's like it's kind of in-universe, but it looks like they've taken an awful lot of liberties if it is, you know. So I don't know. I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
That's what it all comes down to.
So the main topic on this episode of the Rogues Radio Podcast, we're going to be talking about the 24-hour comic book day challenge. Now, for those of you that have been listening to the show for, I guess, right about the time that we started it, this will actually be the second time that we brought this up. We do have another episode where we talk about it a little bit, and I actually interview some of the creators that actually worked on last year's 24-hour comic book day challenge. This is the new one. Now, a little bit of background on this particular one that we did this year, as well as last year. Both of these events were fundraisers, and it's for the Clark Memorial Library in Clarkdale, Arizona. So that's an interesting thing. Now, you may be asking yourself, well, how is it a fundraiser? Well, it's a fundraiser in that we take pledges for the number of pages that we complete. And then also, number two, there's basically a tip jar that's out. So if people want to donate something to the library, you know what I mean, because they enjoy what we're doing or whatever, they can do that as well. There's an element of kind of performance art to this, in a weird sort of way, because people just like, I guess, watching us do it. But beyond that, it's just kind of fun that this is also a charitable event, and it basically raises money for the library. And it also is connected to Clarktoberfest, which actually Clarktoberfest is actually this coming weekend. We're recording this. This is the 2nd of October. And this weekend, which is normally when the 24-hour comic day challenge happens, is actually Clarktoberfest. It is happening in Clarkdale, Arizona. I think it's the Downtown Business Alliance will actually have copies of the book that we produced. This one, as well as the one from last year, they will have copies of these books for sale. So if you purchase those, that money also, again, goes to help the library and the Downtown Business Alliance and what they're doing there in Clarkdale, Arizona. Now, a little bit of history on 24-hour comic book day challenge. Now, the main two people I always hear associated with this is actually Scott McCloud, who actually wrote the comic Understanding Comics, and then also Stephen Bissett. Most people would be familiar with Stephen Bissett because he worked on Swamp Thing, but both of them did the first ones. And I think it was either a dare or a challenge that if someone could actually do it, and Scott McCloud, I think, was the first one to do it, and then Stephen Bissett was the second person to do it. Now, many years later, it became like a regular thing and an actual event, which usually happens in October. Now, that's how it started. Now, for me, and I know I'm running a little long on this segment, but there's a lot of background on it. My understanding was that this is an outgrowth of actually something that happened in the Golden Age of comics back in the 1940s. According to a lot of the information and what I've read, the original 24-hour comic book day, or the 24-hour comic book idea, actually comes from an original Marvel Comics issue that basically had Namor the Submariner fight the Human Torch. Apparently, the book was behind deadline, and in order to get it out, they took a group of artists, locked them in a room, and basically brought them food and alcohol or whatever. They went in, and 24 hours later, they came out with this classic issue of basically Namor, a water-based character, fighting the original Human Torch, which of course is a fire-based character. So in the spirit of that, that's how we approach ours. So its members of the Northern Arizona Cartoonists Association basically locked in a room for 24 hours, and we basically try to create a comic with, again, we walk in, we have a bunch of tools and stuff, but we never have a preconceived idea or notion about what we're going to do. We just get in the room, lock the doors, and whatever happens is, you know, what is created on paper. So, Eric, how familiar are you with the 24-hour comic book day challenge?
I'm just familiar with different creators over the years. For people that don't know a little bit of my background, you know, I used to help run the Phoenix Comic Con. And so I met a lot of creators through there. And then I also started an organization called the Arizona Comic Book Association. So I met a lot of comic creators through that. And I just remember from time to time people participating in these challenges and just thinking what an interesting idea it was and how fun it might be. I myself have participated in film challenges of a similar nature. They have 24, 48, 72-hour challenges, but I've never had the opportunity to participate in a comic book 24-hour challenge. I think it actually would be a lot of fun.
It is fun. It's pretty grueling in my personal experience. I won't share my sleeping in a bank vault story again because I still haven't shaken that. Actually, because of that, this last year, the sleeping area was in an open area with an open door. It was a regular room because there was an area that could have been kind of like a vault that for half a second people are going, oh, we should sleep in there because no light will get in. It's like, oh, forget that. So I actually set up the cots in the sleeping area like in this other. Now, there is an element of this that I think is kind of crazy. We did the challenge this year in a hotel that's basically under construction. So there were no walls. It was just framing. There was some brick because they were remodeling part of it. But it was mostly basically a building that was framed. To go to the restroom and access part of the area we were using, you had to basically duck under caution tape. At night, we were basically drawing it to a couple of people had brought desk lamps, but the majority of the light was basically construction lights that we were drawing it to. There was no AC. There was no heat. It got a little warm during the day, and it got pretty friggin' cold at night. And it was definitely a challenge. It was very inhospitable circumstances to an extent. I mean, it was to me, it almost was kind of like if we were doing it almost like in a campsite with just maybe better light, you know. But it was pretty weird. The original story, because of where we were and the history of Clarkdale and whatever, it was basically a ghost story. And that story's title is actually The Last Train from Clarkdale, playing a little bit off of the song. But in addition to that, it was very much a ghost story. The one this year was a little bit different in that a student of the Janimals, my friend Janmark, who actually was the host of the video show I do, which is a component of this show, the retrospective show. He actually, one of his students actually came in who was a fourth grader, if I remember correctly, and he actually pitched the idea for the story. Now, I don't think he might have spent a lot of time developing it, but we just kind of loosely took his idea and then ran with it. You know what I mean? But it was interesting because he actually came in and pitched us on the idea of the story, and his pitch was essentially a sequel to the original story. So this year's installment of the 24-Hour Comic Day Challenge book was a little interesting in that the idea was actually pitched by, if I remember correctly, a fourth grader. My friend Janmark, the Janimal, he actually used to be the host of the Retrospective, the video show that's a component of what we're doing here. One of his students came in and kind of pitched the idea. And his idea was loosely a sequel to the original book. And so he kind of took his idea and kind of ran with it. So the original one is, of course, Last Train from Clarkdale. This one is actually Lost Boys from Clarkdale.
Hmm.
So just as a curiosity, what do you think of this idea of having a fourth grader come in and pitch an idea?
I love it. I think that's awesome. I think that's really cool that that he was able to participate in this and contribute like that. I think that's great. It's kind of interesting. You know, I can only relate, as I mentioned earlier, from the perspective of doing a film challenge. And typically when you do a film challenge, the first day or the first interaction you have in a film challenge contest is they kind of set these very broad parameters, and it would be different for every challenge. Like, for instance, they might give you a line of dialogue that you have to put in the film. They might give you a theme, but they almost always gave you a prop. And there were these certain little things that everybody had to have in their films. Do they have anything similar like that when you do a 24-hour comic book challenge?
No. I mean, I guess if you did like one of the official like events or whatever, they might. The way that we do it anyway, there isn't really like any kind of, I think the only really condition is, which wasn't even a condition, was since it's a fundraiser for the Clark Memorial Library, the event takes place in Clarkdale. It's associated or considered a part, I would like to think it's a part of now, a part of the lead-in events for Clarktoberfest, that obviously it needs to connect to Clarkdale, the actual town, you know. So that would be kind of the only condition. But like I said, it wasn't like a specified thing. It was just something that kind of made sense. I remember the first year we did it, I had like all these kind of rules in my head for things that we had to be careful not to do, because you basically fall into a trap and you make the book incredibly difficult to produce. So, you know, generally, like, it's never a good idea to do a team. It's not a good idea to do likenesses. You want to stay away from historical locations. You know, in my mind anyway, in order to do it, you want to kind of simplify the idea a little bit so it's something that's a little bit easier to produce. However, we broke all of those rules in the first year. It's historical locations. It's different time periods. It's a team of people. It's likenesses. It's all those things and then more, the first book that we did. And the second book, because it is very much a sequel, what is a sequel to the original one, it does a lot of the same things. It's actual locations. It's actual likenesses again, because a lot of the characters return from the first one. It was very interesting. Now, with the first year, we didn't have as many people participate as we did this year. So I'll run down those people that participated in it real quick. So the Janimal returned. He organized the first one. He organized this one. Danny Roberts, who worked on the original one, he returned. Deshaun Gaines, who worked on the original one, he returned. And then, of course, I worked on it again, and I did it the first year. Now, the people that were new who came on board, which is really interesting, is Al Sparrow, who's a great cartoonist and a writer. He actually, of course, you know Al. Al was the writer on Red Skirts. Al came in and participated this year. Ricky Killingsworth, who I'm quite a fan of his stuff, he's a big Jack Kirby fan, and he self-publishes a bunch of comics that he's created. Ricky Killingsworth came out, and he actually participated. And then, of course, I told you the fourth grader. I'm just going to use his first name, not his last name, because I don't know how the rules work with that kind of stuff since he's underage. But we'll just use his first name, which is Cairo. And he actually participated. Now, he was only there at the beginning and then right there at the end. So he wasn't there for the 24-hour challenge. That was just the main artists I just listed. And then Art Gecko, who actually worked on the original one, he actually did the cover for this one. But he did that kind of after the fact. He contributed the cover later. So we did have a pretty good-sized crew, but there was still a lot of heavy lifting on this book. I did as much as I think in some ways more than I did on the last one. I think it was really weird because everyone wanted this one to be better than the last one. So I think we kind of made it harder on ourselves instead of making it easier. I always show up the 24-hour event pitching the same basic idea. Our barbarian wandering the desert, you know, fighting a monster. That's what I want to do. Because I think that'd be a little, you know, not easy, but easier than what we've done, you know. So because it's a sequel, you know, that kind of puts a condition on it. Because it needs to obviously continue to stay connected to the town and reference locations, you know what I mean? That puts a condition on it. But those are all self-imposed conditions. They're not, you know, quote-unquote, you know, rules of the challenge per se.
Well, what about the different roles of the participants? Like, for instance, again, as I can only relate from what I've actually participated in doing a film challenge, the positions are always designated. You know who the director is going to be. You know who the director of photography is going to be. You know who's going to be grips, you know, who's responsible for, say, lighting, for sound. All that kind of stuff is always prearranged in a challenge like that. Is it similar in a comic book challenge where, for instance, say you're designated as the penciler and someone else is designated as the inker and so on and so forth, or is it a little different?
Well, with this one, what's interesting is I know we specify writers, but as far as the art chores goes, pretty much what happened last year is what happened this year. So I'll run it down real quick. So what happened with this year's book is Deshaun Gaines, or D as we called him. Deshaun actually, he actually was the writer on the first one. So he basically took Cairo's idea and added his own spin on it and basically kind of adapted it. So he was very much the writer in that he broke the story. You know, what was going to happen on each page. Al Sparrow, who was also a great writer, Al came in and Al actually wrote the dialogue and actually did a lot of the initial thumbnail drawings that kind of suggesting, you know, kind of ideas for how to lay out the pages, right? Actually, like small breakdowns. And then as far as everything else went, whoever was up grabbed a page. So there wasn't really like this person's a pencil, this person's an inker. It's like you just grabbed a page and you did it. So on the pages I worked on, my pages I did personally, I did everything on those pages. I did help out and do a little bit on other people's pages kind of here and there as they asked. So it's kind of like there's a scene, for example, or a page in the book where someone's looking at a book and there's all these vampires, pictures of vampires. And so someone asked if I would just do the vampire drawings. I was like, sure, why not? You know, so I draw these vampires on this page. But that's all I did on that page. I didn't ink it or anything else. And then Al Sparrow actually did several pages. The Janimal did a lot of pages. Ricky Killingsworth did several pages. Danny Roberts, just like he did last year, came in and did a tremendous amount of pages. But it's just whoever's available, they just grab a page and go. So it's not the usual delineation and the way you normally produce a comic where this person's a penciler, this person's an inker, this person's a letterer or whatever. Now, Al Sparrow did also letter the entire book. So it's interesting because the letter is probably the most consistent thing in the book. You know,
that is really interesting just as a concept, you know, for anybody that's not familiar with how comic book publishing generally works. That's certainly not the way that you normally do it. You know, it's almost unheard of that other than perhaps, you know, sort of a ghosting situation where maybe somebody becomes ill or falls behind a deadline or something like that, which especially, you know, which was very, very common, especially in the golden age of comics. But still, it you know, the idea there is that, of course, somebody you'd be emulating somebody else's style to keep it consistent. It's interesting to me. So does the book end up being very, you know, from page to page, really look different?
It does. It's very erratic. The original book was the same way. It's also very erratic. I personally feel like that kind of gives the book its charm. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because we have a lot of fun with it. I think the original book is at times pretty gruesome,
which is, I think, a little shocking for people. The second one is I think, a little bit more humorous. And definitely, well, it definitely has more of a sense of humor about it. One, because Al's scripting it. And then number two, all of us were just kind of having fun, just kind of running with the gags. You know what I mean? There was a couple of pages that when I read the dialogue as I was sitting down to actually draw the page, I actually laughed out loud. There's some kind of funny moments in it. I don't know how other people are going to take it, because again, at 2 a.m. when you've had no sleep, you know, things are funnier than, you know, when you're, you know, I guess we'll call it lucid.
Right.
But it's interesting, because normally on any kind of project, you know, artists are very protective of their work, and there's always, you know, standards, conditions, and all this other stuff. But what's interesting about the NASCA group as a whole, you know, and every artist has an ego, but as far as the group is concerned, everyone is just about creating a fun project, you know, and there's not a lot of egos that would prevent someone from feeling threatened that someone else's page is following someone else's, or at least no one says that. I don't take a lot of offense to it. I find it kind of interesting, you know, to just, but it's, but also too, to be bluntly honest, I think it's the only way that sometimes you can complete a project like this. You know, if I had to ink the whole book, I wouldn't be able to hold a pen at the end of it.
Right.
You know, I would be in so much pain physically. I mean, just at my age, I can't ink for 24 hours straight anymore. I have tendonitis in my thumb on my drawing hand, and I couldn't do it. So there's that. Because the pages I actually did are kind of quick pencil rendered pages. So it's kind of a different style than what people are probably used to seeing me do. The original one was just kind of inked with kind of gray tone wash with like markers and stuff. And it's interesting too, because the pages sometimes are a little bit more fleshed out and finished than you would expect them to be, but then other pages are kind of rougher. So I'll have to send you, I meant to send you a copy of it, but I'll have to send you a PDF of it or something so you can actually see kind of how it turned out and you can kind of see it.
Yeah.
It is very erratic.
I'm very, very curious. I'm very, very curious, because that sounds really, really interesting. I'm also curious about how do you credit something like that?
Well, I mean, I always put the books together in their final form. Like I just take them, I scan them really quick. And then I lay them out in InDesign, you know, page one, page two, blah, 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 whatever. The cover design is kind of set because I had designed it last year. So we kind of keep the cover design kind of consistent. And then as far as the crediting goes, on the front, I typically list everyone's like last name, you know, so it says 24-hour comic book day challenge 2019. This is, you know, Janimal, Roberts, Gaines, Sparrow, Killingsworth, Cook, and then Beatty. And this is Lost Boys from Clarkdale. You know, it's got the NASCA logo on it. And then the back, because I'm actually holding a test copy of it, on the back, it says the story credit was Cairo, the fourth grader who came in and pitched the idea. The writers were Chris Deshawn, or D, and Al Sparrow. And then the art, I just list whoever worked on it, you know, Janimal, Danny Roberts, Al Sparrow, Ricky Killingsworth, and then myself. And then the cover art is just Art Gecko. But yeah, I guess it's because I started out as a ghost, you know, working on books uncredited, you know, drawing backgrounds and stuff. I just look at, it's just production, you know what I mean? It's storytelling, but it's production. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If someone needs help to finish a book or finish a page, you just jump in and help out. You know, you don't, I mean, I view collaboration as what it is, collaboration, and it can be a great thing. You know, collaboration to me only becomes painful when people become too precious about something, you know, and at the end of the day, hopefully everyone's trying to make the best thing that you can, and you have to trust and hope that they also want to make something that's good. You know, you can't really, I guess that's my thing, is I've never been too precious about things. You know, my main goal is to just, you know, complete a fun, entertaining story, you know, and it's like I said, it's a little bit more erratic then I think, you know, maybe it could be if we had more time. But then again, that's the nature of this. It's, you know, you're doing it in 24 hours. And whatever you get on the other side when the sun's coming up is what you get. So,
yeah, I think one of the things that's unique about these types of challenges or so satisfying about these kinds of challenges is that the bottom line is you have something that's done at the end of the process. And that's huge. I think that's huge for any creator because now you have something that's done. And so often with creators, you get into a, you know, you have an idea, you want to do something, and it just sort of ends up in development hell, and it never actually gets produced. So I think that's got to be something that's so appealing about this kind of process. Like I said, I can relate on the film side of doing a film challenge. It's always nice because you know there's something done at the end of it.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's really cool about this too. I mean, we've got two completed books that we've done. You know, that's really cool. And then I know we were talking about, you know, how much longer do we want to do this? And I know Jan likes the idea of maybe doing it a total of 7 times. And then we can collect it all together in one huge volume and call it A Week in Clarkdale.
That's a neat idea right there.
So, yeah. So that's probably what we'll wind up doing, as long as everyone's still willing. I know I'm still down. I mean, I just had a lot of fun with it. And you know, I got to say, even though everyone's style is very different from each other, it's very inspiring. I mean, these guys are warriors, man. They just get in there and they knock it out. You know, it reminds me of a lot of my experiences, you know, creating comics over the years. You know, comic creators, they're very hardworking individuals normally. I mean, some people, again, I think get a little too precious and whatever about things, but... No, we get in that room and it's everybody's helping each other and it's all about a common goal and they're just warriors. They just get in there and do it. You know, it's inspiring. It always makes me realize that I should have done more. For example, I think sometimes in my mind a little bit too precious about what we're doing with Red Skirts. And because of that, you know what I mean? I've been probably taking too long, you know, on getting everything together for us to roll out Volume 2, you know. There's a lot of stuff completed that no one's seen, but I'm still tinkering with it, you know? And there's no reason for that other than maybe I'm being a little bit too precious with it, you know? And it makes me realize it's like when you see how productive everyone is and you see what you can do in 24 hours, it makes you realize it's like, you know, my output for the year maybe should have been higher than what it was, you know? So it inspires me and encourages me to try and be a little bit more productive and a little bit... I don't know. It's interesting. It's interesting to see something like that come about.
Well, there's definitely something to be said to be working under a deadline. You know, as you know, with your professional work with Marvel and DC, you know, you had to deal with deadlines all the time. When you're self-publishing or you're an independent creator, well, that can kind of go by the wayside because you don't really have a deadline necessarily. You know. The deadline is whatever you decide it's going to be in your head. So I do think that this is one of those things, again, I can relate with it on the film side of it, having done film challenges like this. It helps people, especially a lot of people who have never even done professional work. It helps them to understand what it is like to actually work under a deadline and you've got to get this done in this amount of time. And because otherwise, a lot of times people wouldn't do it. And that's kind of the reason that they never get their project finished in the first place. It's because they're kind of putting it off. It's never quite right. I think I related to you one of the last challenges I did, which was years and years ago. I could tell we weren't going to make the deadline. I knew we were not going to make the deadline because I could tell the director was just being trying to be too perfect, you know? Trying to treat the project the same way that she treated her normal film projects, where she basically had as much time as she wanted, as long as the actors were willing. Well, that just wasn't the case here. You know what I mean? So it was a situation where it had to be done at this certain time, and I knew we weren't going to make it. I could just see it. You know what I mean?
Right. No. Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like I know that with Red Skirts, for example, and it was an active production, you know, we were trying to have a page out a certain time every week. And then when we got to the end, we wanted to take some time because we did have some gaps there. And so it was like, and then before you know it, you know, those gaps, you know, get out of control. You know what I mean? It's like we didn't mean for it to happen that way. But yeah, and that's kind of the thing when you're doing a project like this, like you were just saying, you can't. Oh, and that's the way I kept describing it. You can't get too precious with it. You know what I mean? You, and I probably say, you know what I mean, too much on this show, but it's true. You can't be too precious. You have to understand that you have a deadline. I remember the first year we did it, I was really sweating bullets because I think it was getting on about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and we didn't have that much done. And then we ended up finishing with about an hour to go. And then this year we finished with about an hour and a half to go. And actually we probably could have finished a little bit faster than that, but we had people coming in because again, this is a public event. You know, the doors were open pretty much the whole time. So we had people coming in all hours of the day and night, you know, coming in and visiting and seeing what we were doing and checking in on us. And, you know, again, because the whole idea is for people to experience this and see where we are. So it wasn't uncommon to have a visitor at, you know, an ungodly hour come walking in to check out what we were doing, you know. So, but no, yeah, and that's the thing. You can't be too precious about it. You know, you have to understand we've got a deadline and we got to get it out. And I'm very proud of the work that we've done on the first year's book, and I'm very proud of the work that we did on this year too. I don't know if one's necessarily better than the other per se, but I'm just very proud of what we've done as a group, and I love the idea that it's a fundraiser too. You know what I mean? I feel like, you know, we're doing work and then, you know, doing a little bit of good work too. So I think. So I'm here at the 24-hour Comic Book Day Challenge. This is going to be Year 2, Volume 2. I'm sitting here with Danny Roberts, this fantastic cartoonist who completely killed it last year.
Oh, well, I wouldn't say that, but we're definitely here for the sequel.
Yeah. So, Danny, why don't you tell us a little about the book that you do and a little bit about your background?
The book I do is Atomic Cattle Drive. I got two storylines going on with that. One would be kind of akin to Andy Griffith and Opie going into space in a retro Buck Rogers era. The other storyline is Martian brothers living in the Old West trying to integrate themselves into the Old West. So those are the two storylines I've been working on. And I have just been doing comics off and on over the years, but I haven't quit my day job yet.
No, yeah. So. I hear you. I mean, I have a day job, too. I think most of us, that's how you survive. And, you know, you do comics for fun, and if something breaks, great. And if not, you know, you just continue to do what you love.
So, right. Yeah. And that's what I do it for more than anything. It just out of pure joy and fun of right. The creative process.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, I know that you have a background in comics because when you're from the area, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I grew up in Prescott and moved over here in Cottonwood several years ago because the secret is Cottonwood is a lot like Prescott was back when I grew up.
Ah, okay. So. Got it. Now, I think, what was it, there was a publishing company in Prescott once upon a time. Didn't you try for them?
Oh, Gladstone Publishing. Yeah, that was my big first break into comics was that I went to go work for Gladstone Publishing as an inker for their old Dick Tracy comics. So they were going to take all the old newspaper comic, clean it up a bit, and then publish it. Unfortunately, the very week I was hired, they also lost the contract with Walt Disney, so I got laid off literally the same week I got started.
Oh, yeah. The age-old story. I've got some of those myself. I hear you. So now... I know that you do the Verde Valley Comic Expo every year, correct?
Yes, yeah. My wife and Jan Mark had started that, I think, 4 years ago now.
Yeah.
So it's been a great, great success, and it's really been a good way to bring the creativity of everybody that lives in the Verde Valley, or Northern Arizona, I should say, right. all together. And that was kind of the catalyst that kind of brought us all together.
So, yeah, yeah. So.
Now, you were talking about sort of Andy Griffith show, Buck Rogers kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of stuff that you find inspires your art? Like, are you more of Alex Raymond, Flash Gordon kind
yes,
of guy?
Yes, I love all the old newspaper strips from the 30s, 40s, 50s. They're eye for detail, which is fantastic. You know, and these guys were just cranking these things out on a daily basis. And it just, you look back at it and you go, man, that is just phenomenal. The detail, the inking, and they weren't adding color to a lot of this stuff, and to just be able to give it such depth with just straight black and white, it's just awe-inspiring for me. So that's kind of the angle I've been looking for.
Yeah, very cool. It's interesting, too, because it's amazing how many of the Golden Age comic artists that either came through Arizona at one point or came to Arizona and stayed here until they passed away.
Right.
It's pretty crazy. When you go back and you get into the bibliography, like one of the original Buck Rogers artists, for example, actually came out to Tucson and was apparently working on a ranch at one point.
Yeah, right.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah, and I think, as I recall, the original Buck Rogers character was a cowboy that eventually became a pilot that became lost in the future. So, you know, there's a lot of Western elements in creative sci-fi, I should say.
Right. So when you're drawing your comics, what are your favorite tools? Like, what do you like to use the most?
I usually use the blue pencils, you know, the non-photogenic blue pencils.
Yeah.
And I don't do it the way you should do it. I just kind of go from panel to panel, literally telling the story to myself as I'm writing and drawing at the same time. And that's just part of my creative process. I also have created the spacesuits needed for my characters, and by doing that, it adds to the whole creative process.
Right. And you're talking about actually physically, like you have the actual spacesuits that you can wear.
Right. So I built myself the space helmets and the backpacks and the spacesuits and go, yeah, this is what it would look like after I build it, and then I wear it when I draw it, just for fun.
Right. Reminds me of... what was that? There was the show like in the 70s that was a comedy show, and the guy was a comic artist, and he had the puppet.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember the name of that. And the puppet would actually draw.
Oh, boy.
Because he couldn't draw it without the puppet on his hand, remember?
Yes.
Anyhow, I don't remember the name of the show, but it reminded me of that.
Boy, that one takes me back. But yeah, I don't remember the show at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, that for me, that's just part of the creative process. And it's been a long road for me to discover that was my creative process.
Right.
So, you know, here I am 53 and I'm still trying to find my true creative venue.
Right.
So it's all good.
Well, very cool. Well, now I know people could obviously pick up copies of your book and get T-shirts and all that kind of fun stuff at the Verde Valley Comic Expo.
Right.
Do you have like a website or anything where people can?
I do. I have a website, and I also have a Facebook page, AtomicCattleDrive.com, all one word, and a Comic Cattle Drive for Facebook, and it pulls it up. So.
Cool. All right, cool. So. And we'll definitely be sure to post show links as well. Well, thanks, Dan, for
no
being
problem,
on the show.
Dave. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Okay, so now I'm sitting here with Ricky Killingsworth. Ricky, tell us a little bit about the comic that you do.
Well, I do several comics right now. They're based off of one story that I developed back when I was about 16 or 17 years old. I'm 65 now, so it's had time to flower.
Cool.
And that's pretty much it. It's just something I've always wanted to do because I always enjoyed Jack Kirby's stuff, and I just wanted to do something kind of to memorialize him in my mind.
Right. Well, I've seen it. I quite like the book. I think it's pretty amazing. Now, you said Jack Kirby. Would you say Jack Kirby's your main influence, would you say?
He was my whole influence until I was, from the time I was five, which I learned to read at five. And I probably didn't read anybody else's books I can think of until 68, 69.
Wow. Okay.
Then I started drifting into the DC universe a little bit.
Right.
But I wrote him all the way 72. I wrote him into the fourth world. I just loved him so much.
Cool. Very cool. Now, How did you get started drawing comics?
I won every award you could win at my school as far as art. And one year I kind of got shafted. And I decided I was going to go on ahead and... College was where I was going. I had to get an art degree of some sort. Went to college, kind of got disappointed there because I wanted to draw comics. They wanted me to paint trees. So it just didn't blend. I was 19 and I kind of got full of myself. Thought I was ready for the big time. Sold everything I had, my car, my guns. I was a hunting guide at that time.
Yeah.
And I moved to New York. I finally got a hold of Jim Shooter. Met with him for what appeared to have been a really good meeting.
Right.
In the end, he said, "We're looking for pencilers. Your pencils are very weak. I love your inks, but your pencils are weak. We're not hiring inkers." I think that was just a nice way of letting me down, actually. But as I went outside, I sat down. But before I even sat down, a gentleman walked up and asked me, you know, "Do you work for Marvel?" And I said, "Well, no, I wish." He said, "Let me see your stuff." I showed it to him, and he pointed down the street, and he said, "They're starting up another comic company down there called Seaboard Periodicals," which was Atlas.
Yeah, yeah.
I wandered down there, showed my stuff. They immediately picked me up, and I survived about 9 months. It was kind of toward the end when Larry Lieber had taken over.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got to know him so well. He saw... It was amazing. I didn't even know who he was.
So you didn't know he was Stan's
brother. I had no idea till about a year after I'd gotten home, somebody told me that.
Right.
But he was the nicest man, the hardest worker I think I've ever seen. And he it left an impression with me.
Yeah.
And the day I went in and let him know that I was leaving, he came over to my table and I was kind of shocked that he did that. And he put his arms around me and he said, "You're leaving at a good time, but don't give up. You do have the talent." And I guess that just, that's been my drive ever since then.
No, yeah, well, that's very cool. Very cool. I know that you exhibit at the Verde Valley Comic Expo every year, right?
Yes.
Now, obviously, people could come and check out your books there and possibly, you know, pick them up. Do you have like a website or something?
I have a Facebook page, randommolecules.com.
Very cool. Very cool.
And
awesome.
I put everything I can on there. I probably have too much, but it's fine. Right.
Well, that's very cool. Well, I want to thank you for being on the show. I want to encourage people to go check out your Facebook page, buy some of your books, support what you're doing. I think it's pretty amazing. So thanks for being on the show.
Okay. It's wonderful being on the show. Thanks,
awesome.
Dave.
Cool. Thank you.
I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Rogues Radio Podcast. Again, my name is Dave Beatty, and I've been one of your hosts. If you'd like to learn more about me, see some of my work, all that kind of fun stuff, you can always check that out at my website. My website is davebeatty.com. That's www.davebeatty.com. And I want to encourage anyone, if you're in the area, if you're living in Arizona, if you're out in Phoenix or something, you're looking for something interesting to do this upcoming weekend. Again, this is being recorded on October 2nd, 2019. This upcoming weekend is going to be the Clarktoberfest in Clarkdale, Arizona. I'd encourage you to go out there and check it out. Lots of live music, lots of food vendors, different people selling different things. It's kind of a fun thing, celebration of the town. But also, too, you'll have the opportunity to buy both copies of the original 24-hour comic day book that we did there, The Last Train from Clarkdale, as well as copies of the brand new one, the sequel, Lost Boys from Clarkdale. Anyhow, I want to encourage you to definitely check that out. I want to thank Eric Alexander for coming on board and doing some great co-hosting duties yet again. Thanks for being on the show, Eric.
I appreciate being here. And if any of you are active on Twitter, you can always find me on there at BassGod14. That's at BassGod14. And then also, I've been doing some weekly supplements on YouTube for this show. Pretty short little videos, anywhere from about 10 to 20 minutes long. And that is also BassGod14 on YouTube. And please keep in mind Bad Bob Productions.